This is an ABC podcast.
This is the South Australian Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hello, welcome to the South Australian Country Hour, this Queen's Birthday holiday long weekend. Great to have your company today on the company on the Country Hour. We're going to hear from some of the recipients of the Queen's Birthday Awards. There's some great recognition for agriculture there. And we'll also hear what agriculture has to say about the South Australian government's plan to open up kangaroo harvesting to farmers.
For me, it's not something that's new. At the moment, there would be approximately 5 people on our books that are shooting their own property, and we've had others in the past that have done exactly the same thing.
That's coming up on the Country Hour. Yes, it's a big day for those award nominees, and recipients, I should say, and that will be coming up in the next 10 minutes or so. But first up today, the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission Deputy Chair Mick Keogh says some quad bike manufacturers are, quote, playing with lives by resisting mandatory rollover protection. The comments come as the ACCC today closes its consultation on a raft of quad bike safety recommendations, which could make fitting rollover protection devices mandatory. However, Honda and Yamaha say the ACCC has got it wrong and have doubled down on threats to leave the Australian quad bike market if that recommendation becomes law, Lucas Forbes reports.
Since 2001, more than 250 people have died in Australia in quad bike-related accidents. The ACCC is recommending that manufacturers install rollover protection devices, otherwise known as OPDs. But the industry has been vocally resisting the measures, something ACCC Deputy Chair Mick Keogh says is disappointing.
We keep reminding them that there is an average of 16 deaths a year from rollovers or from accidents on quad bikes. Half of those are from rollovers where the person is crushed underneath. And they are playing with lives in this opposition to providing this sort of protection, and we regard that pretty seriously.
Honda and Yamaha have both threatened to pull out of the Australian quad bike market if these changes go ahead. Honda Australia Motorcycles and Power Equipment Managing Director Robert Toscano says OPDs are unsafe.
Firstly, those products don't improve safety. And secondly, there's no real criteria for, you know, what's the standard of those products. Then we have no choice but to withdraw based on that one item. So we can't sell products in Australia that, one, we know from our own research is not safe, and two, there's no standard to build against.
Mr. Keogh says the industry is relying on computer simulations to make the case that OPDs are unsafe, while ignoring real-world evidence that they improve quad bike safety.
There have been quad bikes fitted with rollover protection, around 10,000 we estimate, based on incentives provided by various state governments. None of those quad bikes that have had rollover protection have been involved in an accident causing injury or fatality. The tourism operators who've applied them have indicated a dramatic reduction in the number of injuries occurring, and even the largest landholder in New Zealand, Landcorp, indicated that since applying rollover protection to their quad bikes, they've had at least 3 accidents they know of where injuries were avoided because of the rollover protection. Unfortunately, the industry seems to be prepared to rely on computer simulation modelling. We noted the industry's views, but must admit that we felt that they were not as reliable as some of the other information we had available.
Yamaha marketing manager Sean Goldhawk says there's evidence from around the world that OPDs either don't improve safety or even hinder it. That includes a University of New South Wales survey of fleet managers. However, the report actually says fleet managers thought OPDs prevented more serious injuries. However, Mr. Goldhawk accused the ACCC of twisting the numbers.
We've done research with the Dynamic Research Incorporated. We've also have a University of New South Wales survey of the workplace fleet managers, which reported that with OPDs, 50% of injuries occurred. Without OPDs, only 30% of injuries.
The researchers on that study concluded that when managers were asked whether the OPD prevented serious injury or caused injury, the company manager's response was that the OPDs prevented injury or more serious injury in 10 of the 12 rollover cases. This survey identified that overall the fleet managers considered the quad bar generally protective. So is that just a case of twisting the numbers a bit to make it look like there's more of an issue than there is?
No, we feel that actually it's the other way around and that ACCC are twisting the numbers to suit their case, because we have evidence from the UK Health and Safety Executive that has rejected OPDs. There's three coronial inquests that have also rejected OPDs and recommended more behavioural safety measures that have been embraced by the industry.
Charlie Armstrong is Chair of the Workforce Productivity Committee of the National Farmers Federation and Chair of Farm Safe Australia, and he backs the ACCC's recommendation on rollover protection. He says the battle of OPDs is reminiscent of the auto industry's initial reaction to the introduction of seatbelts.
The same sort of battle was had where the manufacturers refused to do it, and it was only through legislation that we finally got seatbelts in cars. Now, they're going to do all sorts of things to try to defeat it. We've had over 100 fatalities in the last, the last 10 or 15 years with quad bikes in Australia, and not one. There hasn't been one recorded that's had either of the quad bar or the lifeguard or any other specification, one that meets specifications, a crash protection device.
Mr. Armstrong says he's confident OPDs will be mandatory in Australia eventually, despite the protests of manufacturers.
We'll get there in the end, but it's certainly taking and is harder to get to the obvious solution of saving lives and reducing massive injuries than we thought it would be.
That was FarmSafe Australia Chair Charlie Armstrong ending that report from Lucas Forbes. And submissions to the ACCC's consultation on quad bike safety closes at 5 p.m. today, so you can go to a government website for that. But what do you think about these recommendations that that perhaps rollover protection could be made mandatory? Do you think it would be a big expense if you needed to get a quad bike up to code, or do you think that this is something that the industry really needs to do to ensure the safety of people who are riding these bikes? We'd love to hear your thoughts. 0467 922 783 is the line to text in on, or you can call in on 1300 222 891. It's 12 minutes past 12 here on the Country Hour, and we've got an eclectic mix of Queen's Birthday honours for rural and regional South Australia. Dr. Derek Bailey from Oruru received an AO, which is in the is an Order of Australia for distinguished service to agricultural economics, particularly sustainable development and reducing poverty. And he says he took an academic path because his parents realised he was no good at farming.
When I finished in Oruru, I was sent to Adelaide, and to the Adelaide University. I studied agricultural science because I was from a farming background. And then my parents were pretty smart, and they realized I wouldn't make a good farmer, but I might have some potential somewhere else. So I was encouraged not to come back on the farm. And so I finished up doing my doctoral studies in the US, and that led me into international agriculture. So back in the 70s, I went off to work in West Africa, and then from then on to several other countries around the world, including Mexico and Pakistan and Ethiopia, before I finished up coming back to the US to work in the World Bank.
And as you can hear, it is a good thing that he decided to apply his intelligence into the world of agricultural economics, because his work has, as he said, focused on reducing poverty through agriculture.
Well, I worked for many years at the International Maize and Wheat Improvement Center, which is headquartered in Mexico, but much of my work was in India and Pakistan. And that was a center that was responsible for improved wheat and maize varieties that were used around the world, including in Australia. So I think one of my contributions in that area was to help design varieties that would fit into the
complex farming systems of small farmers in South Asia, India and Pakistan. And the other major contribution may have been in the World Bank, where I led the World Development Report for 2008, which was on agriculture. I mean, that was the first time it had been on agriculture for many years. And I think that helped promote investment in agriculture for poverty reduction and food security.
That was Dr. Derek Biley speaking there. And Dr. Peter Dry has also worked in academia. He's an emeritus fellow at the Australian Wine Research Institute, and he was awarded an AM for services to viticulture and wine grape research. In his far-reaching career, one of the areas that he's worked in has been preparing Australia's wine industry for a changing climate.
During my time at the Australian Wine Research Institute, we developed a research-to-practice program in alternative varieties. And the aim of that was to inform the industry about, the implications of climate change, global warming, and the need to have grape varieties which were much better suited to the changing climate, to a warming climate. So that was done, 10 years ago, and I continued to be involved in that area. And I think it's great when we see the success of some of these newish varieties, particularly in the Riverland and Sunraysia and so on, varieties such as Fiano, Vermentino, Multiple Ciano, Nero d'Avola and so on. I think it's just fantastic.
How involved were you in getting some of those alternative varieties into the country?
Well, not directly, but indirectly. I visited Europe and I saw a lot of these varieties and I talked about them at various, industry workshops and such like. And it's been, the wine companies and so on, largely, and to some extent, the CSIRO, who've introduced those varieties. And also, back in the 70s, I wrote about the need to change our variety profile and the need to introduce these varieties. So I wrote an article on that in the Grape Grown Winemaker in 1980, I think, and the importance of matching these new varieties to climatic zones. So, yeah, I think I've been around for a long time to see all that happening.
Part of your interest has been drawn from your family. Can you explain how?
My family has always been involved in agriculture, but I had been in viticulture for about 15 years, and I was doing some family history research, and I discovered that I had a great-great-grandfather, Joachim Zirk, who was a grape grower in the Brossa Valley in the 1800s, and I also discovered he planted a block of Shiraz vines in 1887 and still there today. So that for me was one of the greatest days of my life to discover that I had this ancestor who was a grape grower.
How significant is your recognition in this area to showing the importance of viticulture to agriculture in Australia?
Look, I've been privileged to have worked in the Australian wine grape industry, and it's a fantastic industry, as it is indeed around the world. And I think I've made a contribution in many ways to through the extension of information, doing some very applied research, and also disseminating that information by means of workshops and books and so on.
Dr. Peter Dry, AM, speaking there. Now, Adna Mutna woman Faith Thomas has also been recognised today. She was the first Indigenous woman picked for any national sports team when she bowled for Australia in 1958. She was also one of the first Indigenous nurses here in South Australia.
Well, I was quite surprised, actually. I worked at Point Maclay, Point Pierce. Then I went north doing patrol. But I worked also at the Alice Springs Hospital.
You helped deliver many, many babies during your time as a nurse. What
yes.
was that like?
Well, that was good fun. I thoroughly enjoyed bringing all them babies into the world. You just sort of think, did I do that? Did I bring that one into the world? You know, they're just people that are very special to me. Mm.
Adnyamutna woman Faith Thomas speaking there. And Gwyneth and Jack Crombie, and Jack is also known by his birth name, Katajunti, from Kubupedi, and they were awarded an OAM for their service to the Indigenous community. Gwyneth and Jack met when she was working as a nurse in Kubupedi, and since then they've moved many times to parts of the Northern Territory and the APY lands and through parts of South Australia, partly through their work with the Red Cross, where they were setting up training to help foster cross-cultural understanding between white and Indigenous communities.
We also set up and established a training package, and this came about from Jack and I working in the two worlds and sitting down talking with family on a personal level. I was hearing things that you don't normally hear at a meeting or that people don't readily talk about, and there was some awful problems because of some very minor misunderstandings resulted in very bad outcomes. So we set up this training package, first of all, to assist young bush people going to Alice Springs, Kubupedi, Port Augusta, wherever, and helping them understand white fella laws and the need to have their motor vehicles registered and have a driver's licence and things like that that a lot of people didn't understand. We went on to deliver that to contractors and the Aboriginal workers on the housing program at APY Lands. We delivered it for a different version of it for Red Cross staff going to work out on communities. And in Port Augusta, there's some various organisations in Kubupedi as well. And then we were asked to deliver it to the prisoners at Greenbush, the large prison in Port Augusta. So we revamped it again to suit and help assist the prisoners adapt to a life outside of the prison and what they were going to do and what support systems were there for them. And after doing that for a couple of years with Port Augusta Prison, we were then asked to do it at Port Lincoln Prison. But Jack decided he wanted to come back to Kubupedi, he wanted to be back on country. So we moved up here back to Kubupedi a couple of months ago.
As a couple, you've worked to break down cultural barriers. How have you done that?
But through respect, mainly. If you respect somebody else's culture and they respect yours, it's quite easy. And being willing to have open conversations where people really listen and understand, put things into context, demonstrate what you're talking about. And, you know, some of it's been very easy, some of it's been extremely difficult, and then there's some that you just go, well, that's different, I don't fully understand it, but it's different, and you accept that that's the way it is.
What does it mean to you to receive this award?
Oh, it's, it's quite thrilling. It's a huge honour, and great that a job that we both loved, or work that we both loved, and what we did, and not expecting or wanting any thanks, we felt we had more than our thanks by being able to make a difference in people's lives and help assist them. That this has just been really the icing on the cake for both Jack and I.
That was Gwyneth Crombie speaking there on behalf of her and her husband, Jack Crombie, about their award that they received, their Order of Australian Medal that they received as part of the Queen's Birthday Honours. And we say congratulations to all the recipients of awards this Queen's Birthday Honour Roll. You're listening to The Country Hour. It's 24 minutes past 12.
Grandstand's coverage of the 2019 Cricket World Cup.
Bowled! Two stumps out of the ground.
Gets an outside the off stump. Oh, brilliantly caught it back a point.
And he hits him high. He hits him long. For six!
Don't miss a minute.
Down the pitch this time. He's launched him over his head. It is a six. Balls is edged and is caught.
The 2019 Cricket World Cup. On now. And coming up in August, the Men's and Women's Ashes Series. On Grandstand Digital and on the ABC Listen app.
As you heard earlier in the program, the ACCC is looking at changing some of the requirements for quad bike manufacturers that could see rollover protection being made mandatory. We've been asking for people to text in. The number to text in on is 0467922783. Mike Sanders has texted in with an idea on these recommendations, saying, why don't they invent a cutoff switch that activates before the motorbike tips over? Thanks for your thoughts. They would be interested in hearing whether you think this is a good idea, or, I mean, Mike's idea is a good idea, or perhaps some of the other ideas that have been put forward by the ACCC. As I said, that number 0467922783 to text in on. But if you were listening in last week, you would have heard our discussion regarding the government's plan to allow up to 10 landholders to be able to get a license to harvest kangaroos. Well, a Flinders Ranges-based kangaroo meat harvester and processor has welcomed this move, but Taryn Ackland from Oruru Kangaroo also queries claims there is an overabundance of the native animals, saying that her company is struggling with supply.
The state government's announced that they want to expand the commercial kangaroo harvest. Now, you've been in the kangaroo meat game for quite a while now. What's your reaction to this? Do you think it's a good idea?
It perhaps is, but we've had people that have been landowners or are landowners that currently shoot. So for me, it's not something that's new. At the moment, there would be approximately 5 people on our books that are shooting their own property, and we've had others in the past that have done exactly the same thing. So, you know, I think that if anybody's going to want to do it or have an interest in doing it, they've probably done it anyway themselves without this other assistance and help.
So the government's plan essentially is that they've got a pilot program with up to 10 landholders, and they're focusing on Western Eyre Peninsula, but also the upper north, and supporting landholders and getting started. You've just said, obviously, that you believe that anyone who kind of wants to do it has done it already. But do you think any newcomers would be attracted by this idea?
Oh, look, there may be. I'm really not sure. I guess if it's incentivised and if people are keen to, it's a good way into the industry, because as far as I know, and I don't know a lot about what they're doing because we weren't consulted with this, but as far as I know, people are being helped financially or assisted financially to become a field processor. So, yeah, it's probably going to work for some.
So one of the reasons they brought it about is because there's a kangaroo overabundance throughout the state. Do you agree with the idea that there's an overabundance?
I think that at the moment there's probably not that much of an overabundance. There are certainly patches of kangaroo out there that are, you know, there are larger numbers. But we've seen some pretty heavy harvesting by landowners, and not harvesting as such, but shooting by some landowners because of their drought situation. And we've also now seen rain. So at the moment, the kangaroo has scattered, and we're not finding that there's a great deal of numbers coming in at all. And a lot of them are a smaller animal than before. So I would say that, no, there's not a huge abundance. There may have been, but not at this point in time.
And then on another topic, obviously with the government wanting to push this idea of bringing more power to the commercial industry and really making it more of they want to turn the kangaroo essentially into more of a resource to be harvested rather than something that, you know, farmers just have to go out and shoot to control. Do you think the demand's out there for kangaroo meat?
Oh, yes, definitely. I mean, we are at the moment having a lot of issues or supply problems. We can't get enough to finish all the orders that we've got on a weekly basis. So it's certainly a resource. It's a fantastic resource. But, via one way or from one way or the other, we just haven't managed it very well at all.
That was Taryn Ackland from Oruru Kangaroo speaking with Luke Radford. Still to come on the program, it's a highlight of every Queen's Birthday long weekend. That is the Casterton Kelpie Festival, and we will be hearing some of the latest results from that in the next 15 minutes or so.
The first auction was conducted on the back of a ute at the local sale yards, and they cleared $6,124 for all the kelpies sold. Last year we sold the top kelpie for $22,200, and we cleared $264,000 in the 50-odd kelpies we sold.
And that was last year. We'll let you know how this year's festival went in just a moment. But first, we'll hear what's happening in news. We're joined by Luke Radford. Hi, Luke.
Hi, Cass. ABC Chair Ita Buttrose will meet Prime Minister Scott Morrison this week to discuss last week's police raid on the public broadcaster. Ms Buttrose has described the raid on the ABC's Sydney headquarters as being unprecedented and designed to intimidate. She says media outlets need to cooperate to stand up for press freedom. South Australian Governor Hugh Van Lae will stay on as the Queen's representative for a further 2 years. His current term has been extended until the 31st of August 2021. The extension will take his service in a viceregal position to 14 years, which is the longest continuing period of service in South Australian history. It ends weeks of speculation about who might become the next governor, with reports former Foreign Minister Julie Bishop and former Senator Amanda Vanstone were considered. And as you've been hearing on the Country Hour, the Deputy Chair of the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission, Mick Keogh, says some quad bike manufacturers are playing with lives. The comments come as the ACCC today closes its consultation on a raft of safety recommendations which could make fitting rollover protection mandatory. And we'll have more news at 1 o'clock.
Thanks for that, Luke. We'll head over to the Weather Bureau, and now we're joined by Mark Analak. Hi, Mark.
How are you going?
Well, thanks. So it's blue skies now, but what is in store? I know there's a lot of people looking to the skies this week.
Yeah, blue skies, but not for much longer. So for the rest of today's public holiday, as you said, we've got a high pressure system basically sitting over the northern part of our state now, so mostly clear skies across South Australia. Tomorrow, we start to see some high cloud developing across our western border with the Western Australian, South Australian border. So that high cloud is expected to increase and thicken as it moves eastwards across South Australia during the day tomorrow. As it thickens, it develops into a bit of a rain band through western and central parts of the state, probably reaching Eyre Peninsula late afternoon and central districts after dark, I would think. So for Adelaide, probably looking at after dark before we start seeing that cloud thicken up enough to produce the odd spot here and there. So that band will continue to develop and thicken as it moves eastwards overnight Tuesday into Wednesday. So for most parts of South Australia, we are expecting some rainfall. The places that might miss out or are likely to miss out are in the far, far northeast corner, say northeast of Moomba, and the far southwestern corner, west of about Fowler's Bay. But everywhere else in between, in that band from the northwest corner down to the southeast, are likely to see some rainfall. How much? Well, most of it will occur over central and eastern parts of the agricultural area, I would think. And at this stage, if we draw a line, say, Ceduna to Lee Creek to Broken Hill, we're expecting areas south and east of that line to be of the order of 10 to 30 millimetres by the end of Wednesday night. Quite a good rain band developing across South Australia overnight Tuesday and into Wednesday. That rain band is expected to move into the far northeast corner by Thursday and will gradually clear the northeast corner Thursday night. Following in behind the band of rain, we are expecting a series of cold fronts to bring further shower activity to agricultural areas from Thursday through Friday and even into the weekend. So there'll be a series of cold fronts, maybe three or four cold fronts, the first of which will be during Thursday, and that'll bring some periods of shower activity to agricultural areas right through to the weekend. In terms of rainfall amounts, I guess, as I said, the first part, generally in that central and eastern part of the state, agricultural, southern pastoral districts, we're looking at falls of 10 to 30 millimetres. For local falls of 30 to 50 millimetres are possible about the ranges. And the latest information would suggest that the main area for that 30 to 50 millimetres would be the northern parts of the Mount Lofty Ranges, so around the mid-north and southern Flinders Ranges. So southern Flinders District are probably most likely to see those falls of 30 to 50 millimetres on Wednesday. Across the far north of the state, we're only looking at sort of 2 to 10 millimetres and less than 2 in the far northeast corner, I suppose. So some pretty good falls there for the next few days. The further showers through Thursday and the weekend will continue to bring sort of higher falls to southern agricultural areas and the coastal fringes, and that's when we'll probably see the totals getting up to 30 to 50 millimetres. So for those places such as Port Lincoln, Kangaroo Island, southern York Peninsula, and probably the lower southeast, might miss out with the rain band coming through overnight Wednesday, but following in with those series of cold fronts following the rain band, you're likely to see most of your rainfall with those fronts. So just be a little bit patient. You might have to wait till the end of the weekend before you see those falls of sort of 30 millimetres, but it'll eventually get there. And I think for northern parts of the state, once we get through these... Sorry, let's go back. With the cold fronts moving over the southern parts of the state through the weekend, northern parts of the state are expected to be quite cloud-free, so very cold nights are forecast through the latter part of the week and into the weekend with early morning frost patches for northern parts, so pastoral and maybe even into the northern agricultural areas as well. So in short, yes, while it's blue skies at the moment, we are expecting a band of rain to move through Wednesday, producing some pretty good falls across much of the state. While the northern parts of the state will clear up for the latter part of the week and early and the weekend, southern parts of the state will continue to get periods of shower activity as a series of cold fronts move through the south. This has been Mark Analak at the Weather Bureau.
Thanks for that, Mark. Very quickly, what about the east of the state, Riverland Mallee area, that have really missed out but look like they could be in for something in this system?
Yeah, I guess the good news here is that the band looks like it's lining up for the mid-north Riverland and Murraylands districts. So I would estimate falls of 10 to 30 millimetres for those areas, mostly occurring on Wednesday. And there might be the odd follow-up shower for the mid-north and the southern, southwestern parts of the Murrayland with these cold fronts following them behind the rain band. But for the Riverland, probably looking at around the 10 to 20 millimetre mark for Wednesday.
Thank you so much for that.
Okay.
That was Mark Analak from the Weather Bureau. In the far west of New South Wales, the Upper Western's going to be sunny tomorrow. Overnight temperatures are going to fall to between 8 and 12 degrees, but the daytime temperatures will reach the mid to high 20s. The Lower Western will also be sunny. Overnight temperatures there are going to fall to between 5 and 9 degrees, and the daytime temperatures will reach the low to mid 20s there as well. We've had a couple more texts in. Paul says that the VFF are leading the way as a representative group, but and that they have some that they are doing well with their approach to quad bike safety. And a text with no name on it says that quad bikes used for dirt circuit racing have to have roll bars, and they're asking the question of how many deaths from sport when it comes to quad bikes. I don't know the answer to that, but we are grateful to your texts. Please keep them coming, 0467 922 783. It's 22 minutes to 1.
ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
This will be the fifth time this year that we've lost our power. You don't just lose it for a day, now you can end up losing it for 2 or 3 days.
Hear it anywhere, anytime via the ABC Listen app.
Well, while we're speaking about the Mallee region, the Bullabarra farmers from that part of the world have done it again with another funny take on farming. They've put up a video on their Facebook page about seeding time, but along with that is an open letter to the non-agricultural community. It comes in the wake of several agricultural issues recently that have divided public opinion, such as animal welfare and glyphosate, issues like those, and they're calling for farmers and non-farmers alike to put more effort into understanding each other's opinion. But first, Bullabarra partner John Gladigo explains their approach.
My
Oh, there's probably a bit of public pressure, really. We keep getting these emails and messages saying, when are you doing another video? When are you doing another video? And everyone in the team kind of rolls their eyes and says, all right, if we have to. But secretly, I think the guys actually really enjoy it and enjoy the ribbing that they get. So it's just a bit of fun.
What's the theme of this year's video?
Oh, it's called Seeding Time. It's just about the mad craziness of what seeding's all about.
Thursday and we're inoculating. Friday and we're fixing something.
In some ways, there's no way we could have made the video in the first couple of weeks of seeding. It had to be made in the last week when everyone's really, really tired, really, really grumpy, and you're just in this mindset, I suppose, where one day just rolls into the next. You don't know what's happening. You don't know if it's daytime or nighttime. Stuff breaks down. You're eating the same sandwiches every day, but it's all right, and we love it.
It's all potential from here at the moment, so it's a good time of year as well.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And, yeah, you're giving people a sense of what seeding's all about. Largely your page is aimed at the agriculture community. You have a lot of people who like your Facebook page. But on your page you've written an open letter to the non-agricultural community. Why did you do this?
I think the thing is that the realisation, especially I think in the last few weeks when there's been a lot of talk about the glyphosate court case, I guess, is coming up in Australia now, you know, with animal welfare and even a bit of backlash against the ag community following the recent federal election. I think the realisation is that we're all out there having a lot to say, we're all out there advocating as such, but we're talking within the ag bubble. We're all just—it's like we're just talking to ourselves, and we have this feel-good thing because we're all out there talking ourselves up. But the only people who are hearing us are ourselves. So I guess what I was really trying to do is to encourage the ag community to talk to wider than the ag community. But it's not just about talking to and educating. We keep saying we need to tell our story. We need to tell people what we're about. But the reality is that we actually need to engage with people, and engaging is the first step of the process, because if we can't engage with people and drop our guards in some ways a little bit and make ourselves a little bit vulnerable even to allow people to ask us the hard questions, then there's no opportunity to engage, to educate. There's no opportunity to present facts. And so I guess that was the thing. It's the irony of it is, of course, by putting it on your page, in some ways I'm talking within the bubble. I guess I'm hoping, and it seems that has happened in some ways because it's been shared far and wide, that people outside the ag community will actually feel comfortable in coming and engaging with us and asking us questions.
What has the response been?
Quite phenomenal. I mean, it hasn't been out for 24 hours, but... it's been shared thousands of times right around the world, and interestingly, especially within the US, which is fascinating. And in general, it's been support. There's also been some criticism, which is interesting, in the fact that we've had quite a few people even who have privately contacted us and said, John, you shouldn't be exposing us or opening ourselves up, because it's just allowing people to attack us. And I guess I probably feel the opposite to that. I think, you know, we have to take a little bit of risk and make ourselves a little bit vulnerable and be transparent, so that we actually get the trust of people. Because unless we get trust from people in that we are being genuine in our views, we won't get that engagement. If we don't get that engagement, then we don't get the opportunity to educate and present, you know, just what it is that we're all about.
Agriculture doesn't always agree with agriculture on a lot of ideas. There's plenty of farmers who don't agree with GMOs, or there's plenty who do believe in climate change, and those who don't believe in climate change. That agriculture is often at odds with itself.
That's right, and that's fine, and that's very healthy. I think if we were all on the same page, then we'd just be like sheep, and in fact we'd probably have even less respect from the wider public if we were all together. I think the thing is that even within the ag community, it's about having a meaningful dialogue, an open dialogue, and actually being accepting and respecting of everyone's views. The thing is with views and opinions is that no one can absolutely claim 100% that they are right. They are a view, they are an opinion. It's about having a value system. You know, for some people, their value system is that they don't believe that you should kill animals for food. And that's fine. I respect that. That's fine. But what we hope is that those same people will respect other people who actually don't have that same value system and actually believe that animals are put on earth to provide food for humans. I don't have any problem with the difference in views. It's about, I guess, creating forums and creating a culture where, you know, we can actually sit down and respect each other's views, have the discussion, try and understand where each are coming from, and then let's move on together.
Bullabara partner John Gladigo speaking there, and that post, that open letter to the non-agricultural community, has attracted thousands of shares and comments, and it is well worth a read if you are on Facebook and would like to have a bit of a peruse on this public holiday. I think it's well worth a look. It's 1:45 here on the Country Hour, and we'll head down to the southeast, well, even over the border, to the Victorian town of Casterton, because as you will know, it is the birthplace of the Kelpie, and it's now very famous for its annual festival celebrating the working dog. But with the recent opening of the Australian Kelpie Centre, it's gone to a whole new level. In just 12 months, tourism is up and the town's economy has more than doubled, and new cafes are opening and the bakery's been run off its feet. But how did this all happen? Beck Wetham reports.
Want him at that point? No problems. Next up. That's better. And make sure you handle it up and grab the dog before it clears.
The Casterton Kelpie Festival brings thousands of people to Western Victoria every year. But its beginnings as an auction in the mid-90s were pretty humble.
The first auction was conducted on the back of a ute at the local sale yards, and they cleared $6,124 for all the Kelpies sold. Last year we sold the top Kelpie for $22,200 and we cleared $264,000 in the 50-odd Kelpies we sold.
That's the president of the Casterton Kelpie Association, Karen Stevens. She says they started the auction to bring more people to Casterton and celebrate something unique to the town.
Casterton is the birthplace of the Kelpie breed. Back in 1870, George Robinson bred the first Kelpie out at Warwick Homestead just north of Casterton. So if we fast forward to the mid-1990s, Casterton, like many Australian rural communities, was facing decline. And we wanted to actually have something that was quite unique to us, to brand ourselves with something. And we came across the fact that the Kelpie was bred at Warwick Station, just north of Casterton. And that's the beginning of our story.
The Kelpie celebration has grown enormously since its beginnings 23 years ago. 3 years after the first auction, organisers morphed the small one-day auction affair into a national two-day festival to keep auction audiences entertained.
The Saturday is the festival, it's the fun day, and there's all things Kelpie, like high jumps and hill climbs and dashes. But the serious business on the Sunday is about the value of those Kelpies to the everyday life of the Australian farmer and just their incredible instinct and ability just to work, just to continue to work.
But after the huge success of the two-day festival, the town needed a way to keep Kelpie fans happy for more than one weekend. Last year it opened the Australian Kelpie Centre in the heart of the main street. Glenelg Shire CEO Greg Burgoyne says the centre has been a huge boost for the regional Victorian town.
Here in Casterton, the visitor numbers at the Kelpie Interpretive Centre have more than doubled. And we've seen this increase throughout the year. So the contribution to the local economy through the visitor economy is substantial. And it's in the millions. We've seen a lot of activity here through retail growth, through accommodation growth, through a tourism route connected to other tourism routes. So the visitor economy here is booming, and the basis for this is this Kelpie Interpretive Centre and the Kelpie Muster in the June long weekend.
Greg Burgoyne says while people come to Casterton for the Kelpies, they stay for more.
This is bigger than the long weekend in June. It's put Casterton on the map. So Casterton, very much quintessential Australian town. It's a beautiful river town, red gums, and we have the iconic Kelpie breed as attached to Casterton. So visitors come from all over the world to see this iconic breed, Australian breed. It's an Australian working dog that's unique to this country. And here in Casterton, it's the home of the Kelpie.
And while the festival has saved a rural town in decline, doubling the number of visitors and bringing in millions to the state's economy, it's also celebrating a hard-working member of Australian farms.
So she'll go mustering and you'll go for a drive with Mum or Dad if they're out in the paddocks looking at stuff, so she just can have a bit of downtime. But mainly...
16-year-old Claire Foster's family bought Kate at the Kelpie auction last year. And while they paid $10,000 for the working dog, Claire says the new member of the family is priceless.
Quite nerve-wracking it is, because you don't know how much the dog is going to go for or who's going to get it. So it is very nerve-wracking. I remember we thought Kate was going to go to someone else and she was going to... we're going to miss out on her, but... Yeah, we decided to keep going with her and, yep, it was very much worth it, it was.
Great to hear a turnaround in fortunes for the Victorian town of Casterton there on the back of the Australian Kelpie. That was Claire Foster speaking at the end of that story from Beck Wetham. And we have had a phone call in regarding the ACCC's ideas to make rollover bars mandatory. Danny Sheehan from Cummins has said on the phone that he has been riding quad bikes since their inception and thinks that small gaiters or side-by-sides are safer. He's had 7 rollovers on quads, but not on these UTVs. So, and that is something I know in New South Wales, they actually paid farmers to swap over. So there is an acknowledgement that they are potentially safer. Thanks so much for that that call in, Denny, and saying that the quads are just too light in the front, and that's part of the problem. We'll head to dairy now, though, because last week we told you the story about the supermarket Coles announcing that it would be directly sourcing milk supplies from farmers directly. And the news has been received with some caution locally. But in Queensland, the reaction has been even stronger. The Queensland Dairy Farmer Organisation says it's difficult to trust the intentions of the supermarket and that potentially it is capitalising on consumer sympathy for the dairy industry. Matt Trace is Vice President of the QDO and he says there needs to be more unity amongst the dairy states. He spoke with Nikolai Balhartz.
Well, I suppose the track record of Coles, as many farmers would be aware, is not great for the dairy industry. And we're certainly concerned about the transparency and the genuineness to actually help farmers from this deal.
One of the things you mentioned is the fact that you think that Coles is capitalising on consumer sympathy. Can you expand on what the thinking is there?
Well, clearly there's been a mass campaign around increasing the price of milk in bottles for direct payments to farmers, you know, because of drought. But anyone in the dairy industry knows the drought's just the final straw. It's actually the discounted pricing from the retailers and, you know, not just in milk, also in cheese and other dairy products. This is the reason our industry is in such a state in Australia, is actually because of the retailers' behaviour. So... yeah, sure. We're very worried about what they're actually trying to do here.
And one of the other things too, I gather you flagged concerns about is I guess the negotiating power of individual dairy farmers?
Yes, it's very difficult. It's tough enough for a collective bargaining group or a co-op or whatever your group might be to negotiate with someone like Coles and Woolworths. And at QDO, we've talked to many processors that have had very difficult time with it. So what hope can one farmer have in actually achieving a good deal? You know, like we've got to look at a few of the things that Coles have said about the 10-cent increase on milk here, and that they said all of that money will be passed directly back to the farmers, Well, we know that's happened in the northern industry with Norco through a transparent process, but it's very confusing what's happened with the Saputo deal. Now Saputo stepped out of this situation and Coles is going to take it on themselves. You'd really expect that anyone who's signing a deal to supply Coles would receive 10 cents a litre above what they were receiving before, or you know, roughly $1.30 kilo solid. So I'd be very interested to see if Coles is doing that and genuinely passing on all of that 10 cents a litre increase, or if they're betraying consumers and tricking them into letting them, you know, think they're helping the farmers.
Some of the farmers that we've spoken to here in Victoria say that essentially there's no loyalty to processors anymore, like there might have been in the past, and that now if the price is good enough, they will go there, they'll go to Coles. Is that something that you've come across as well?
Oh, for sure. The industry's changed in Queensland the exact same, that there is less loyalty to processors. And, you know, who could blame a farmer for wanting to do a deal to pick up an extra couple of cents when they're struggling? Like, I certainly don't blame them. But this goes back to one of the weaknesses in our dairy industry that needs fixing immediately, and that's unity. We don't have unity within a state, let alone across the country. And I think all of our bodies need to work a lot harder to achieve proper unity so we can stand together. Because I can tell you, if Queensland, New South Wales and Victoria stood against Coles on this, that we wanted to force collective bargaining and make sure all farmers got some money out of this, it would happen. But right now, it's just every man for himself.
That was Matt Trace. He's the Vice President of Queensland Dairy Farmers Organisation, speaking there to Nicola Bailharts. And finally today, a Huon Valley cider maker appears likely to lose a large amount of cherry juice and some blueberry juice due to smoke taint from the January bushfires in southern Tasmania. The smoke from the fires has caused several winemakers in Tasmania's south to abandon winemaking this year, but it's believed to be the first time it's occurred with fruit juice like cherries and blueberries. Harry Moses is the general manager of Pagan Cider, and he told ABC News that they will hold on to juice until next season to see if they can blend it into other products.
We realised in January, whilst we were pressing, there was some talk about the local vineyards expecting smoke-tainted grapes. We decided to send some fruit juice to Vintessential in Hobart, a laboratory, and they tested it, and the smoke compounds were present in the fruit. So we then decided to see if that will have an effect post-fermentation, and 2 or 3 weeks later, after the fermentation was complete, it was very evident that it was very smoky, very ashtray in flavour, and not usable for the product that we intended it for.
So how many litres of juice have you lost from this?
36,000 litres. We started exporting into Thailand in February. Those inquiries began some years ago. The inquiries for Hong Kong were after the fires and after our discovery of the smoke taint. So we have said to them that we would love to obviously export to Hong Kong, but we can't take any orders until after next cherry season, so we're not prepared to fill them. We have existing customers who've supported us for years, as well as the new unknown growth of the Thai market. So we're just sort of keeping our powder dry in order to just get us through to next January. The smoke compounds, if there's sufficient parts per million, will be absorbed by the wood, the leaves and the fruit. The fruit has to be sweetening up for the compounds to actually set within the fruit. So the compounds basically bond to the sugar molecule. So if you were to eat the fruit as a smoke-tainted fruit, you won't detect it. There might be a few people on the planet who could, but generally no one will pick it up. It's only when you ferment it and you use up the sugar molecule and free up the smoke molecules that you will be able to detect it, because the receptors in your mouth will pick up the smoke. And it's very much like an ashtray, which who wants to drink an ashtray? If we calculated what 36,000 litres is worth in a finished product, it approaches $1 million. But that's not to say that we would sell all of that in 1 year. So, but the cost of that juice is nowhere near that. The cost of processing it is nowhere near that. But there's a hell of a lot of costs in producing it, the apple cider that goes with it, the bottling, the labelling, the transportation, everything else. So that sounds like a big number, but there's not much fat there.
Harry Moses, the general manager of Pagan Cider, on the effect of smoke taint on cherry and blueberry juice. That's all we have time for in the Country Hour today. Final text message in response to John Gladigal. Muzz says that animals evolved, they weren't put on the earth for our use, just like us. Thanks so much for those texts today. It's coming up to 1 o'clock, therefore, time for news.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.